You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Stephen McGowan was en route from London to South Africa on a once-in-a-lifetime trip by motorbike, returning home to Johannesburg. He had reached Timbuktu in Mali when he was captured along with a Dutch and Swedish national by Al-Qaeda Islamist militants. Nearly 6 years later, he was eventually released, and I'm delighted that he's told his story in a book called 6 Years a Hostage, and even more delighted that Stephen is able to join us now. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you very much.
Wow, what a story. I must confess, I often watch them. I don't know if you have them in where you are, but the programs which are called Banged Up Abroad on National Geographic. And, you watch them and think, goodness me, surely there aren't as many people in the world are having such bad luck as this. And you're certainly one of them, Stephen.
Yeah, no, Bill. I mean, certainly, So I'm in South Africa. This is where I was born, and I began my career and everything. But most certainly, it's funny how life has a plan for us, doesn't it? And it's not always exactly what we're expecting.
Certainly not. As I mentioned there, you were en route from London to South Africa on one of these kind of once in a lifetime things. I talk to people all the time on the show who are doing kind of trips around the world on a motorbike or doing like a long journey. That for you must have been a glorious thing to be setting off to do by motorbike, returning all the way home to Johannesburg.
Yeah, for sure. This was a lifelong dream of mine. You know, we had a farm in an area called the Orange Free State in South Africa, a very mountainous area. And since a youngster, literally since I was sort of in nappies, running around with gumboots on, knee deep in the mud, I had this desire, this passion to ride a bike through Africa. I'd always been very passionate for Africa. It's just such a unknown part of the world. And since the age of 15, I had this wish to ride a bike through Africa. And really, like you say, my wife and I returning back to South Africa, this seemed the perfect opportunity for me to live out my dream.
You nearly made it back. You got as far as Mali, in fact, in Timbuktu. Tell us what happened. Am I right in saying you held then a British passport?
Yeah, 100%. I'd been living in the UK for 7 years prior to this. I was working in banking there, absolutely loving my time there in the UK. But my family were involved in farming back in South Africa. So the idea was to come and get involved in our farming business, obviously with some, with some links to the UK, with a bit of import-export.
Yeah.
But the plan was to come home and take over the business. So this really was my dream. And my wife allowed me six months to ride my bike back. From London, from Putney, back down to Joburg. And anyway, my 6 months ended up becoming just short of 6 years.
So, absolutely.
Crazy. A bit of an introduction. I mean, I suppose, I was about 2,000 kilometers into my trip out of about 12,000 kilometers. So it really was early days. I was still up in North Africa, up in the desert area. And really, for me, the desert area of Africa isn't really Africa. For me, Africa is big trees and, big birds. And so my plan really was to get out of the desert as fast as I could and start to live my dream.
Yeah.
But In November 2011, and it sounds a long time ago, but quite honestly, I've only been out the desert now for 4 years. So 2011 Goodness. Was the other day. I arrived in Timbuktu, traveling with some other overlanders. You know, we met en route, all very exciting. Our plan was not to stay in Timbuktu, you know, very long because I really battled riding a motorcycle through heavy desert sand. I kept falling off and my bike was too heavy and overpacked.
Right.
So our plan was to stay there very briefly. And we arrived, we were there literally a night. And the following day, a bunch of Al-Qaeda militants, Mujahideen, walked into our auberge where we were staying on the northern side of Timbuktu, on the edge of the desert. And they came in with their AK-47s. Three of us were kidnapped. It was a hell of a day. Didn't really make sense. But that was the start of my next 6 years out in the Sahara.
Absolutely. What a hell of a day is an understatement. There was an immediate tragedy, was there not, that there was a fourth man there, a German tourist, who refused to go with them. And I believe he was sadly killed on the spot.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. He was putting up some resistance. I mean, he wasn't resisting, you know, by throwing punches and screaming and shouting.
Right.
He was just gently, quietly pushing people off him as they try to drag him across to the Land Cruiser pickup. And he tripped over and, he fell down about 5 meters away from us where one of the Mujahideen just decided this wasn't working. They have to leave. We have to leave Timbuktu quickly. This guy's putting up resistance. Let's just kill him to make a statement. So they shot him. They shot him 3 times in the head.
Goodness me. And I guess that answers the question, Stephen, you know, what people would do if in similar circumstances. Would we put up a fight or would we just go, you know, it's really not sensible here? Those thoughts must have gone through your mind too, I would have thought.
Yeah, you know, it's I mean, exactly, 100%. You know, we all think we're a hero, but I mean, I think for me it was a lot about trying to be rational about the situation. You know, my mind raced at 1,000 beats a second, trying to figure out what are the options. But after evaluating, and I mean, my mind worked far quicker than it ever worked previously.
Yeah.
After sort of looking at an idea, evaluating it, tossing it out that it wasn't an option, I eventually just decided, well, you know, these guys have got guns and I'm no superhero. I need to actually just go with them and see how this plays out. Obviously, Martin, the other hostage who was killed, he had a different idea.
Yeah.
We all react differently. And who's to say how we're going to react? I don't know. It's only when you're really in it that you understand yourself.
Absolutely. And the Dutch hostage, Mr. Rieke, who was there, am I right in saying that his wife was simply not noticed by the hostage takers and therefore escaped?
Well, no. So she was noticed.
Right.
So we were 5 people there actually in the auberge on the day.
Right.
But according to Al Qaeda, and I know this isn't very politically correct, according to Al Qaeda, women are complicated, so they decided to leave her.
Oh, okay. So, wow.
So yeah, but I mean that isn't the real reason. That was most of the young Al Qaeda members who basically just came out and said, "Women are complicated. We don't kidnap them." But in actual effect, within the Quran, it basically states that old men, women, and children should not be harmed. So that is why we left her. Okay, but there is a caveat, except if they are challenging Islam. So,
right.
So somebody who works in a democratic government, somebody who works in the police, somebody who works in the military, somebody who's perhaps Christian and actually going to a Muslim country to spread Christianity, they are all targets.
I see.
So as we were tourists, Tilly was left behind. Yeah. But subsequently, just if I may add, subsequently there have been some ladies who have been kidnapped and are still sitting in the desert, but they were there spreading Christianity.
I guess the $64,000 question is, what was the point of kidnapping you? You had nothing really to offer them. You were just a guy traveling through on a motorbike. What was it they wanted from you?
So exactly. I mean, I was a tourist. I was a tourist. And it turns out I was then held as a prisoner of war for a war I wasn't even fighting in or really not really even aware of. Okay, so why did they kidnap us? I mean, really, their argument. Okay, a lot of guys say, well, it's for ransom.
Yeah,
I don't believe that.
Okay.
I don't believe that. I believe it is purely to fearmonger the West, fearmonger the rest of the world. So whether I was shot and killed, or whether I was bitten by a snake or died, or whether I was negotiated out of the Sahara, is all relatively irrelevant. The biggest, you know, the biggest thing is to hit the media and to say, we have kidnapped somebody who is from a Western country, and the Western countries are so strong and world powers, but actually us little guys on the ground can sneak through and we can still get at you, you know, yeah. like with the Twin Towers in New York and all the rest.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, I mean, I don't think it really is so much about the money. As far as Al-Qaeda goes, they would far rather do a prisoner exchange.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know I had a British passport.
That's interesting. So that wasn't one of the reasons why they kidnapped you then?
No, but it certainly was a very big reason to hold me for the next 6 years. And, you know, out of us three hostages, I was probably the most favored from a point of view that I probably had the most, I was the biggest bargaining tool.
Yes.
Being from the UK, but also I was probably the most hated and also probably the most likely to be executed. So it was terrifying. I mean, you know, being held by guys. I was in London during the 2007, King's Cross, and 2007,
yep,
wasn't it?
Yep.
I was in London, you know, and I'm working in the city, and I cycled home that afternoon back to my wife, back to our house through eerie streets in London.
Mm.
You know, so I had experienced what Al-Qaeda were capable of. And as in my early 20s, during the whole Twin Towers, I experienced that from Johannesburg, watching with open mouth, you know,
yeah.
staring at the TV. Is this actually happening? So I was very aware of it. Yeah, I mean, Al-Qaeda, they are what they are. They're a bunch of terrorists. And it was absolutely terrifying knowing what they're capable of.
Sure.
And knowing how my situation may end, you know, with a blade across my throat or being shot, executed.
Describe the people that kidnapped you. Were they young? Were they a mixture? Were they aggressive to you? Obviously, they're aggressive because they carried a gun. But what was their kind of demeanor?
So I could probably equate them back to some big multinational or to some big corporate. I
mean, right.
There is senior management, there's middle management, and there's basically the juniors. And the juniors don't really know what they're doing. I think half of them are there purely because they're on the gravy train. They're there maybe yeah. to have an adventure, you know, to get given some clothes, given some food. I think mostly because of the adventure, you know. If you're sitting in the desert next to a well, and you're now, let's say, 20 years old, and you've been there for your 20 years, and then a friend of yours from another well comes driving in on the back of a Land Cruiser with a Kalashnikov. He's just come back from Libya.
Mm.
He's got all these stories about mirages and missiles. I mean, you're going to stand there and think, well, I spent my last 15 years walking a herd of goats
yeah.
between our little grass hut to the well and back, you know, 5 kilometers. That's my life.
Yeah.
This guy's seen the world. So I think a lot of that is why people, the juniors, would enter into Al-Qaeda. Middle management were mostly guys who were from cities or relatively educated or just a good IQ, you
know, right.
maybe from the Sahara, but they were quite altogether. But the senior management, they were doctors and accountants, and they were people who were from mostly Algeria and mostly the northern North Africa countries, that, you know, like along the Med.
Yeah.
They had been to varsity. And they were really the strategic mind behind what they were trying to achieve.
Amazing. And presumably good English speakers then?
No. Not at all. Not at all. I think during my time in the desert, there was one guy who spoke English because he was basically English. There were a couple of guys, maybe five guys, who spoke absolutely awful English. They kept referring to the Sahara as the forest.
Oh.
We go to the forest, you know, and I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. We go to the desert, not the forest. So there were a couple of these guys. And then the majority of them spoke a thing called Hassaniya, which uh-huh. is West African dialect of Arabic,
yep.
but of French, but they didn't want to talk French. They didn't like the French, so they didn't want to actually learn French.
Uh-huh.
But with time, they realized the importance of learning French. Obviously, being French West Africa, they realized they could read road signs, and it actually benefited them from a military perspective to be able to understand French.
So describe for us, if you can, Stephen, for the benefit of our listeners, what kind of conditions then you faced when you got to your eventual place of kidnap, if you like, and were you moved around or did you stay in the same place?
So, yeah, you know, this was one of my huge anxieties, you know, lying in the back of that Land Cruiser, driving into the desert. I had no idea what to expect.
Sure.
Did Al-Qaeda have a physical camp? I mean, were we going to be held in a camp behind barbed wire with mud huts, perhaps a bunker? I had no idea. But it turns out that, you know, you could literally pick a spot, well, in your garden and chop down the trees, obviously no trees, a few trees in the Sahara. Mm-hmm. You could pick a spot in your garden and you could camp there for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And then we could pick up today and we could go to the other side of your garden and camp there for a few weeks. Obviously, the distances were far greater, between 500 up to maybe 500 kilometers travel
right.
over a few days to change camps. But it was a very makeshift campsite, which would never be seen as a campsite. It was literally just a piece of dirt where we would then put ourselves down for the next while.
And I'm assuming that you were shackled in some way. What was that situation?
Yeah, early days we were most certainly. And it's quite funny, hey. You know, being handcuffed. In the beginning, our hands were handcuffed until Al-Qaeda, with their vast knowledge, finally realized that we could still walk. So they then moved the cuffs down to our ankles, and then we spent a bit of time being cuffed. You know, with having our ankles cuffed. When we changed camps, we'd be blindfolded, and you know, it's not the movies, hey.
It's
actually terrifying. You know, I do a lot of corporate talks. I've been doing a lot of corporate talks in South Africa and also, you know, a bit of Europe and Southeast Asia, Australia. And I think it was end of last year, I was doing a talk and describing handcuffs, and it actually left me with a lump in my throat and basically in tears. And it really caught me by surprise because obviously there is the emotional angle, you know, will I die? Won't I die? What's my family going through? What are my friends going through? Will they negotiate? Will I ever go home? 1,000 questions.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that handcuffs had such an impact on me. But like I say, I ended up in tears during that talk. And handcuffs are incredibly debilitating.
Yeah.
You sit there, your hands are locked together. Somebody could walk up and slap you about, chop your fingers off. They could do as they pleased. You could scream and shout, and you would probably be greeted by a laugh. You know, they would probably look at you and laugh at you and say, look how this non-believer is behaving.
Yeah.
You know, pathetic. So actually, cuffing really does run deep. It's quite incredible.
Absolutely. Now, of course, the point of them having you there was to tell the world. So at what point was the world told, and who did they contact, and how did they contact them?
Yeah. Okay. So how is a very good question. That was something right from day one. I, you know, obviously with all my insecurities of being kidnapped, I really wanted to try and figure out, you know, I was in banking, I was in finance in London. So everything is very organized and structured and controlled, and there's a process. And so right from the beginning, I was like, okay, I've been kidnapped. Now, when does the first proof of life start? When do my family find out?
Yeah.
When, and how? What's the process? How do you get the information out? And obviously Al-Qaeda, you know, we were prisoners. They didn't need to tell us any of this except basically demanding proof of life, et cetera. So very fortunately, our first proof of life actually took place the first day. The day after we were kidnapped, which was a huge relief for me because at least I thought things were going to start moving. But you also realize at this stage that they make the first proof of life, and then, well, how does it get back to my family? You know, how?
Exactly.
So basically, in 2015, I did a proof of life video in April. I think it was the 4th of April, 2015. I did a proof of life video. It turns out it arrived back with the real world in August 2015. So my family were obviously celebrated. They were fantastic. You know, our son is alive. My husband is alive.
Yeah.
And then they look at the date and they say, well, April, May, June, July, August, 4 months, you know, 4 months have taken place. Maybe he's not alive. Maybe he's actually dead. Maybe he was alive 4 months ago. So that was a tricky one for everybody involved. Hope, despair, hope.
Absolutely.
Despair.
For those of us who've seen the movies, you say it's very much not the movies. What was the kind of conditions you were kept in? Were you properly fed? Were you abused when you were there? Or were you pretty much left alone and kept as the kind of prize, you know, the prize animal, in effect, that they could then barter with at some point?
So We were called a slave by one mujahid. His name was Abu Mariam. He was from Senegal. he came in. He was having a bit of a bad day, I think, and he was screaming and shouting. And he then called the Dutch hostage a slave. And then he was basically reprimanded and pulled up, and he was said, no, they're not slaves. They are prisoners of war. So that at least made it clear in our mind, you know, what are we? But to be fair, if we were slaves, we must have been the laziest, most unproductive slaves that they'd ever come across, you know?
Yeah.
So generally, you know, it was just an incredibly long waiting game.
Yeah.
For me, the anxieties, you know, the bullying, if you like, it was a mental bullying. It was a mental bullying. You know, I was told, you know, the Dutch hostage was told, you know, maybe you're going to go home in the next 2 or 3 months. And they looked at me and said, you've got a British passport. You know, you could be here forever. And I tell you, when you're sitting with a few other hostages, the two guys I was kidnapped with, you really pray that you are 18 and you're being negotiated out as 18. And the minute you hear you aren't, you start to realize just how vulnerable you are, that really the other hostages may go home. And I've got an indefinite prison sentence.
You know, yes.
This could go on 1,000 years. People say they don't negotiate with terrorists, but I think countries do negotiate with terrorists, you know, under the radar. But I could have been there 1,000 years.
Yeah.
So like I say, it was mental bullying. There were a few other moments, you know, where young children were basically telling me my fate, that I was going to be beheaded. And that was terrifying.
Goodness.
When a young kid walks up to you and basically says you're going to be beheaded, not the other two guys, but you are. Think, you know, truth from the mouth of babes, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, the adults, yeah.
And so you mentioned their negotiation. The South African foreign minister at the time said that the government did not subscribe to the payment of ransoms. Yet there is some dispute. I think it was a retired European intelligence official said that €3.5 million eventually changed hands. What's the truth there, Stephen?
So Bill, maybe I can ask you that question because I actually don't know. I've heard a number of stories.
Right.
Okay? I've heard a number of stories. I mean, obviously, you know, living in the UK for 7 years with my British, you know, like with my British passport, and really enjoying my time in the UK and having a great time there, you know, enjoying my life, enjoying everything. One of my big terrors about my time in the desert was how did Al-Qaeda see me? You know, were they going to negotiate with the British government or with the South African government? There's upside and downside. Negotiate with the British government? Well, the British government doesn't negotiate. Negotiate with the South African government? Well, they probably don't know how to negotiate. So either way, I'm basically stuck between two countries. And there were times it suited me to be British and times it suited me to be South African.
Yes.
But I couldn't jump ship. I couldn't jump between the two because it would have really shown big flaws in the way I conducted myself and whether Al-Qaeda could trust me or couldn't trust me. I think there's a bit in the book about this, but really at the end I was released, and it came as an absolute surprise to me. It really, there was no pomp and ceremony whatsoever. I was released and I came back to South Africa. I've been to the UK to see some of the powers that be, you know, some of the MI guys and all of this. But as far as how it actually, you know, from a political perspective, how it actually took place, I've heard a few stories.
Yes.
I've heard a few stories. Some,
interesting.
You know, I think maybe I was given away. Other guys say, well, money was paid. Other guys say, well, lots of money was paid. Some guys say €3 million is just petty cash. Other guys say, well, no, maybe it was, you know, maybe it was you and your attitude towards Al-Qaeda that finally got you sort of released out of the desert.
And it's worth pointing out that the other two hostages got out before you. One was freed by French forces and one was released in the June where you weren't. That must have been quite painful, I would have thought.
Yeah. well, exactly, Bill. I mean, you know, that's why I'm the world champion.
Yeah.
and I mean, I said it facetiously, but actually, I mean, I'm currently the longest held surviving Al-Qaeda hostage in the world.
Goodness.
Which is quite a ridiculous accolade, actually. Yeah, but the other guys did go home before me, like you say, 1 month, and then the Dutch hostage went home a couple of years prior to myself.
Well, what a story, Stephen. I said at the start of this, I watch these things on Banged Up Abroad and think, oh, goodness me, this can't be true. And of course, you speak to somebody like you and you say, well, actually, of course it's true. These things happen to people who just are in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's exactly what happened to you. Well, firstly, thank you for coming on and being so honest. Secondly, well done for writing the book. You can get the book on our website, 6 Years a Hostage. And thirdly, let's hope that the rest of your life passes without any trauma whatsoever, Stephen, because I think you've done enough for all of us there, frankly. So good luck to you, sir. Good luck to you.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks, man. I tell you, 6 years is a lifetime. If you think about 6 years as a child, you know, there's no dummies and no nappies. It's a proper person speaking full sentences. So we put what we can in the book. I'm also doing corporate talks around the world. Yeah. I suppose a lot of guys thought I was going to come out the desert crazy, angry, crazy. If I came out at all. But so I do a lot of talks about, I suppose, relevant to COVID, about what it takes in tough times. And but it is fascinating. I mean, who gets kidnapped, quite honestly?
I guess, for those of us who have been sitting here with the COVID crisis for a year and a half, it's a mere bagatelle compared to what you've just been through, So life's a strange old thing.
Yeah, it's all relative, hey?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, Bill, thank you.
No, thank really you. Thank you for talking to us. Today. The book is called 6 Years a Hostage. Stephen McGann, thanks a lot. Take care. Right, and that just about wraps up the show for today. Thank you very much for your company. Thanks to our guests, as always. Thanks to James Wyatt. His book is called The Art of Discussion, and you can get that on our website, tre.radio, and an amazing story there from Stephen McGann. 6 Years a Hostage is the name of his book, and you can get that as well on our website, tre.radio.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.